This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The state's plan to close the access road to Mauna Kea this morning is being slowed by protesters. Take a listen to some of the action on scene as Kapuna explained their presence on the mountain. Here is Maxine Kaha'olelio.
Desecration of our land. Worshipful God, Ale, I give to you as a Kapuna. Like Mayor Kim said, he's 80. I am 81 years old. Oh, I will stand for my brothers. Where's your hearts? Where's your hearts? Let them be. You choose money over us, Kanakama'ole. How can you do that? And you know Kiakua did that. Not Iggy, not Meakim. Kiakua made that for us to enjoy. Not bomb and desecrate our water.
That was just a bit of the dramatic events and the scene playing out atop Mauna Kea. HPR's Ryan Finnerty is there on the mountain this morning. He joins us live on the line. Good morning, Ryan.
Hi, Catherine. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. So, a very emotional time this morning up there.
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, that was Auntie Maxine, who's one of the spiritual leaders of the movement. And she was actually addressing some law enforcement officers in that clip, some sheriff's deputies and officers with the state attorney general's office. They were positioned right around a group of about 8 to 10 people who have actually chained themselves to a cattle guard, which is like a grate in the road to prevent cattle from walking over it. That's about 100 yards up the Mauna Kea access road from Saddle Road, so pretty close to the bottom, and there's still about those same 8 people or so chained to the ground there. They say they will not move until they're either taken away or their demands are met. Elsewhere, there are about 200, maybe as much as 300 people assembled around the bottom of Mauna Kea Access Road in the intersection with Saddle Road. All the construction equipment actually just appeared a few minutes before we got on the air. It's all lined up in a big convoy right now and not making any moves to go up the mountain yet, just sort of staged at the bottom. But not entirely clear when things are going to start happening. Leadership with the organizers with the protests have been speaking with law enforcement officers regularly throughout the day in an effort to sort of lay out the rules for where people can be and where people will be subject to arrest. And so interactions have been pretty cordial, I would say, respectful on both sides, with both sides pledging to a commitment to nonviolence and to minimizing the tension as much as possible.
So how far away are you from the area where the protesters have chained themselves on the road?
I'm just about 50 feet maybe from where everybody's assembled. If anyone listening has been to the area and they can picture it, so there's a T intersection with Mauna Kea Access Road and Saddle Road. That was where the bulk of the demonstrators were assembled this morning. They had kind of established almost a three-tier blockade of the access road, with the bulk of people being at the intersection, and then about 50 feet behind that, there was a line of kapuna, about 20 or so elders, who were just sitting in the road, and they had kind of declared themselves their intent to be the first ones arrested. And that's what the police had said, was that anybody blocking the road would be arrested eventually. That hasn't happened yet. Anyone on the side of the road would be left alone. And then behind the kapuna was the cattle guard. That's about another 100 feet up the road. That was a smaller contingent. Again, those 8 or 10 people chained to it, with another 5 to 10 people kind of helping them, getting them food and drinks and helping them go to the bathroom because they've been chained there since about 3 a.m. this morning.
Now, I know the governor had his news conference late yesterday afternoon because there were rumors circulating that the state was going to do a sweep last night. But he set the record straight on that was not in the works.
Yeah, it seems like law enforcement's doing their best to be very transparent about what's going to happen. They don't really have any, from what I've seen, desire to sweep people out, to arrest a lot of people. They have a very relaxed posture. They've been talking with leaders in the movement throughout the day. I've seen them regularly touching base, just kind of to make sure stays below a boil. But yeah, as of this moment, we don't know. No one in the on the protester side knows when the police are going to move to clear them out, those blocking the road specifically. So we're just kind of waiting. The construction equipment is here, so that's probably an indicator that things are moving ahead, but it may not even be today.
What are the leaders of the demonstrators telling the group?
Well, the big message is nonviolence, to be respectful, to be calm, not to let tensions boil over. They have actually been removing members of their own group that seem to be a little too agitated or a little too emotional because they really don't want to give, in their own words, give the police any reason to arrest them or to treat them violently. So they've, even at a meeting last night that I attended at their sanctuary, which is across the street, they said it's nonviolent direct action, which is things like blocking the road, chaining themselves to the ground. But they're really trying to keep it as calm as possible while expressing their views and what they say is their right to be here.
And you recorded some of that audio of, I think, one of the main leaders addressing the demonstrators?
Yeah, this is Kaho Okahi Kanuha. He's one of the main leaders of the anti-TMT movement and of this demonstration movement. He kind of gave the briefing last night where he outlined their strategy, and his big message was nonviolence. And this was him speaking to a large group of demonstrators earlier this morning after he had conferred with some members of law enforcement.
We can call them in as best as we can, pull to their na'au, to their humanity, and perhaps over time we can hold a hoodie. So remain dignified, remain disciplined, remember Kapu Aloha. Remember that we have a plan, and we trust in it, right? And it's not a end-all, be-all today. I explained back there, if we're playing football, this is just the first drive, not even the first quarter. Got a long game ahead of us.
Yeah, it appears that this will be a very long, drawn-out process of clearing that pathway there.
Yeah, and that's what everybody I've spoken with has said, Catherine, is that they don't have a time limit on how long they're going to be here. They want to be here as long as it takes. Just last night, the gentleman we heard in that clip said to everybody assembled that it's not going to be a one-day fight and it's not going to be a two-week fight, using the term fight as a figure of speech. I spoke with one of the men who's chained to the cattle guard earlier, who can't even get up and go to the bathroom, and he said he's committed to staying as long as it takes. He told me that their goal is primarily to stop the construction of the TMT, the telescope, but that it really is about a lot more than just that one telescope for them. They kind of view this as part of a global movement of indigenous communities standing up, reasserting their rights. He mentioned the protest at Standing Rock over the pipeline a few years ago. They view this as part of that larger movement.
Right, and I know there are many in the community, though, who want to see TMT up there on the mountain, or at least want to see our space studies proceed. This is a big anniversary for the Apollo landing on the moon, and there's lots of attention about what could be in our return up into space. So interesting time. And just want to make sure that you stay safe up there and get enough water, stay hydrated.
Thanks, Kathy.
All right. Okay, thanks so much, Ryan. That was HPR's Ryan Finnerty atop Mauna Kea. We have team coverage on HPR along with HPR's reporter Ku'uwei Hirishi. You can find their reports here on HPR One. In today's backyard quiz, a small history of money. After James Cook's 1778 arrival in Hawaii, a variety of articles were given monetary value and used in trade agreements. Among the most valuable were beads, adze, and from the quarries of Mauna Kea, and small pieces of iron. Interestingly enough, there is no proof that any kind of seashells was given a notable value. Eventually, as foreign arrivals increased, Hawaiians began to think of money in dollars and cents. Dollars became dola, cents became kaneta, and a wide variety of monetary amounts were established during the hapawalu, or one-eighth dollar. The oddest of the monetary system was the Torbert script, issued in 1848 by L.L. Torbert of Maui. Torbert would produce these himself using small squares of a particular type of paper and writing his initials on each note in ink. For our backyard quiz for today, can you tell us what kind of paper Torbert used? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Exposure without consent. That's the story we'll hear from Lee Johnson, the man who took on Monsanto to win nearly $300 million for his diagnosis of lymphoma. We'll hear what he wants to share with the islands. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. His story and more today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
The Hawaiian-style band created some of Hawaii's most recognizable and enduring songs. Join me, DJ Mermaid, on Wednesday, July 17th, as I talk story with the band at HPR's Atherton Studio. We'll hear more about the who, why, and how of this iconic group, and hear a few songs too. Members, enjoy discounted pricing. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org.
Representative Ed Case was in town over the 4th of July holiday. We sat down with him to reflect on his first 6 months of his latest term in our nation's capital and his position on the powerful Appropriations Committee.
You know, for me, this is my third tour of duty, so to speak, in Washington, D.C. I mean, I went to Washington, D.C. as a summer intern for Spark Matsunaga, then U.S. House member Spark Matsunaga, my predecessor representing the 1st Congressional District 44 years ago. And I spent 3 years on Capitol Hill from the age of 22 to 25 then, half of it in the U.S. House, half of it in the U.S. Senate. I decided that that was a career I wanted to pursue. You know, long story short, that took me back to Congress in 02. I served 02 to 07, so 4+ years, very, very full 4+ years. You know, ran for Senate, did not prevail in that race, went back, came home, lived a normal life, if you want to put it that way, for 12 years, great, uh, practicing law and then working for Outrigger Hotels, which I loved doing. But what really happened was that I watched the country deteriorate. I watched the political debate deteriorate. I watched Congress deteriorate. I watched this incredible divisions coming in. And in that, I wasn't different from any other American, I don't think. And then I got wrapped up in a group called the Reformers Caucus, which is a collection. And this was only just last year. It remains a group of former members of Congress on a bipartisan basis, former members of Congress, cabinet officials, ambassadors, senators, governors, folks that have been involved in government. And the commitment of the Reformers Caucus was to reform government, to try to bring it back closer to the people, to try to end some of this division. And I became involved with them early on in 2018 as the congressional race was already underway. And at some point, I just thought to myself, well, if I'm going to get back involved in politics, I'd rather do it from the inside. And that took me to running for this particular election. Now, that has taken me right into now in my first 6 months, because that was my number one focus, remains it. Can we find a better way forward for our country? Can we, in fact, reform our Congress? Can we, in fact, reconnect with kind of the foundations that we all want as Americans? And that has to do with many, many areas. Campaign spending and campaign finance reform is number one. That was my very first priority. HR1, which is the most widespread reform of campaigns and government ethics that in a generation, actually two generations since Watergate, was passed by the U.S. House. That was a major accomplishment, I think. It stalled in the Senate right now. There are a number of other areas that all relate to can we get more unity on some of these incredible issues that we're facing right now, whether it be, immigration, whether it be foreign policy, whether it be social security solvency. All of these things have kind of driven me back in here. And after 6 months, there's some light at the end of the tunnel, but it's obviously a mixed bag. I mean, the division is deeper than when I went the first time as a congressman. But there are, there are things that actually can be done to start to chip away at that.
Now, you managed to get on two really important committees, appropriations and the environment. You were concerned about funding for the military's water system at Pearl Harbor. We just had a major break, and we just had a recent one up at Tripler.
So this is actually a very instructive story, especially the water main break for the military coming out of Wyava, which is their main water supply to Pearl Harbor and all of the military installations that are on or related to Pearl Harbor, plus many, many civilians. So we're talking 100,000 people that depend on one water pipe from Wyava coming down. And that water pipe, everybody has known that it needed to be replaced. And it was already in the pipeline, so to speak, for funding. So the funding was actually appropriated. So not just authorized, but appropriated. The difference there is authorized means, yes, you can do it. Appropriated means, okay, you're going to do it, and here's the money. The money had already been appropriated for that. The project is about a $78 million project. And this is military construction money, which falls directly within my Appropriations Committee Subcommittee on Military Construction and Veterans. That's one of my key subcommittees, where there's 10 of us out of 435 in Congress that are responsible for divvying up a huge amount of funding for those areas. Right in the middle of that project actually being contracted for, President Trump determined that he wanted to divert all currently appropriated monies for military construction, or not all, but much of it, to his border wall on the basis of it being an emergency funding. Now, we can debate whether their border wall needs to be built or not. I'm fine debating that. And we can also debate whether it's an emergency. The key here was that Congress had already appropriated the money. It was already allocated to that project, and he proposed to divert it. Now, I said that was wrong in committee. I flew home, and the next day that water main breaks. So proof in the pudding right there.
And you went out and toured that site.
And
you
out and toured that site. And I said, hey, this is a good example of what we're talking about. I mean, these are priority projects that we have already appropriated money to. And I wasn't the only project in the country. There were other really key projects across the country. Anyway, that battle is still in some ways being waged. But what happened along the way was that We accelerated the actual letting of that contract so that it was no longer subject to the potential diversion of the monies. That was just a matter of, getting into the weeds, really, and telling the military, hey, move this along as fast as you can and contract that out. And so it actually is now fully contracted. But the postscript to the story is that the battle was taken into the courts as to whether President Trump had the authority to divert money already appropriated by Congress. And the courts have just ruled that the answer is no. And so he is actually under an injunction as we speak that says you cannot divert any of those monies.
Right. So whether it's for the Wayaba pipeline or some other
there are other key projects right here in Hawaii that remain on the chopping block. So those are monies that have been appropriated to military construction but are on the list for potential diversion to the border. Those are all now going to proceed to the projects as appropriated, which I think is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I know. I just happened to be somewhere the day they announced that they had that water main break up at Tripler and that they were closing down the VA clinic. And a gentleman next to me goes, how can they close that down? How can they close down, part of the hospital? And he was just, incredulous.
Well, people don't realize how much we really rely upon basic infrastructure, especially in kind of central Honolulu. This is the case all over the state, all over the Pacific, really, if you want to get that far with the military. But let's just talk about the 1st Congressional District, my district for now. We have 110 some odd veterans plus their families in Hawaii, plus veterans from throughout the Pacific that all rely on Tripler and the VA facilities there for their health care. And that's before we even talk about non-veterans that rely upon Tripler for their health care. It is a huge facility. It is central in the Pacific. It is one of the highest rated hospitals, between California and really a long way out to include Japan. So it's incredibly important, but it depends on an aging infrastructure. And this is true, by the way, not just of Tripler, but of many of our military facilities. We've spent a lot of money over the last 10 or 20 years to upgrade our military housing for our families. We have many new projects sprinkled throughout our military installations, whether it be the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, the Coast Guard, and a NOAA, which is an armed service, not an armed service, but a uniformed service as well. But underneath that all, we have an aging infrastructure. It's really a World War II infrastructure that's never significantly been upgraded. So we're talking pipelines and sewers and, stuff that's underground that you've got to worry about. Otherwise, it cripples your entire operation.
Have you had a chance to go out to see the Red Hill facility?
Absolutely.
And what
I've been
are your
in
thoughts
there twice.
On that?
I think that this is a very, very difficult issue right now. I think two things about it. The first thing is that it's an absolutely critical facility for our military defense. It is people. I think that many people do not realize how important it is to our military's functioning throughout the Indo-Pacific region. It's the largest, by far, storage facility anywhere between the mainland United States and well again beyond, Japan.
It fuels the entire Pacific Fleet.
It fuels the entire Indo-Pacific. So we're talking not only about the Pacific Fleet. We're talking about a lot of other stuff that it fuels. So, for example, it fuels the Coast Guard here. It is utilized as an emergency storage for the state of Hawaii and has been used that way when we've had issues. So it is available for purposes well beyond the military. But let's just focus on the military.
Right, national security.
Absolute national security in an era when we're just very, very consciously having to deal with, China and the next generation of China, which is a whole nother area that I've been very, very much focused on. Compare that against the fact that the reality is that the facility does sit over the Honolulu aquifer. And so if there is a major leak that does pollute that aquifer, that's a huge issue. To all of us that live here in Honolulu. Now, some people want Red Hill just moved right now. I can't get myself to that yet. I've got to go through a more deliberate process of saying, well, if that facility is that important, and if it's going to cost $8 to $10 billion to site it somewhere else that is not as good a overall location for our strategic defense, in the world, then I'm going to have to walk myself through a pretty logical series of steps about, okay, can we in fact ensure that it will not leak? Can we in fact be comfortable that the steps we've taken to ensure that it won't leak will in fact be credible steps, and we can in fact, you know, monitor and enforce a very safe facility?
Right, and are we moving fast enough?
And are we moving fast enough? Absolutely. Now, as things stand right now, the military through the Navy, who runs the facility, and the State Department of Health and the Environmental Protection Agency, those three parties are all under an agreement which specifies a very concrete series of actions that have to occur to evaluate choices, options, and scientific scientific reality that is going on at Red Hill. And my message to all three of them, and I think I'm on the same page as the rest of the delegation, is you have to meet those deadlines. We have to get ourselves through this very, very important, vital, strict approach to, as a practical matter, is there a way that we can ensure safety of Red Hill, or is the reality that we cannot ensure it and therefore we have to move it? And if so, then what do we do? How do we do that?
Do you support the idea of double lining?
I could very well support the idea of double lining, yes. I mean, that's clearly one of the options. I mean, fundamentally, the options are threefold. Number one, that you put advanced state-of-the-art technology on the surface as it stands right now. Number two, double lining. The problem with double lining is, first of all, the main problem with double lining is that it reduces the capacity of the tank significantly. And the military says, and I believe them, that in order for these tanks to actually be able to contribute to national security, they have to have a certain capacity. And so if you reduce the capacity by, I think it's 17% by double lining, you're not at what the military believes they need in an actual situation where they're going to really need it on a fast basis. And then obviously the last category of solutions is move it. So it's a tough one, and it's one where again I believe that my role here is to monitor the public health and safety and try to accomplish the military's legitimate purposes to provide national defense, but to move everybody through a very, very honest discussion. The other thing I've said to the military straight up, pretty honestly, is, hey, you gotta be open all the way on this. I mean, this has got to be completely transparent. You know, if the first time you misstate what the situation is, you lose that credibility. You're never going to get it back. And we're going to all need you to have a lot of credibility to get ourselves through this process.
That was Representative Ed Case talking about Red Hill and the other types of military's World War II infrastructure that is aging. Tomorrow, we continue our conversation talking about the environment and immigration. Today, our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat features a story about the fish and coral recovery on Kauai following last year's massive flooding. Reporter Claire Caulfield is on the line this morning. Welcome aboard, Claire.
Thank you for having me on.
Hey, so I recall with this that initially there were reports that, hey, the fish are rebounding because there weren't so many tourists going down to those areas that they were frequenting.
Yes. So the fishermen in the months directly following the flood were really, really optimistic. They were reporting big fish right near the shoreline, and they said, yeah, there's no tourists to scare them away, so this is great. But the new state data that was just released last week showed that in the entire area, yes, certain fish populations increased after the flood, but overall, in both shallow and deep water, the amount of fish and fish diversity decreased, and the fish were skinnier than in previous years. Most distressing, however, to the researcher I spoke with was the high level of coral bleaching near the shore, where the freshwater from the flood swept into the ocean.
Yeah, that's a big concern. So tell our listeners exactly where were they focusing in on?
So it was actually looking at this certain community fishing area. So this is an area where commercial fishing is banned, and the community manages this fishery area for subsistence fishing purposes. So this is part of ongoing research looking at fish diversity, you know, the weight of fish inside and outside the boundaries to, you know, see if the community fishing area is increasing fish. So this report was just, you know, part of yearly updates on this community fishing area. But, you know, because this flood was so drastic, the most interesting parts of the report was about how the flood changed the fishery.
Yeah, that is a big concern for Hannah. And, you know, obviously the coral bleaching issue is not anything new, but we did have a really bad one a few years back.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this is just, you know, it's a tough time to be a coral researcher in Hawaii. The coral bleaching event of 2014, 2015 wiped out so much coral. And when I asked this researcher, you know, what should people take away from this report? She went really, really big picture with it. She started talking about, you know, carbon impacts, how people can eat lower on the food chain, because she sees coral bleaching directly tied to the amount of carbon in the area.
Yeah, we did talk to, I think, that researcher, that Kutley Rogers.
Yes.
Yeah, and it was interesting because she is, you know, warning folks that, you know, we are going to be getting into the time of year when our waters get warmer. So we've really got to keep an eye out for our coral reefs. There was an awful lot of water that fell during those floods last year. And, you know, I guess all that fresh water has just really done a number on those coral colonies.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the coral bleaching near the shallow area where the freshwater flushed in saw way more bleaching than in the deeper areas, which was why the researchers were able to tie this coral bleaching, or, you know, they said the coral bleaching was probably because of this influx of freshwater because of where the bleaching happened. And, you know, the freshwater also brought in a lot of nutrients, plankton, algae, all sorts of debris. And so that's why you saw that discrepancy in, you know, the reports from the fishermen and then the actual data, because some of the fish, you know, loved that plankton, loved that algae and literally ate it up and were coming really close to the shore. But it was at the expense of sea urchins, coral, and then some of these other types of fish that did not appreciate the freshwater.
Talk more about what the fishermen were seeing return to that area.
Yeah, so again and again, they were talking about, you know, the lack of tourists meant the fish were coming really close up to the shore in ways that they hadn't seen since the 50s. Then these certain types of fish that feed off the plankton and the algae, you know, were big and right near the shoreline, so it made fishing really, really easy for them. Mm. And the fisherman I spoke to, his name's Kali'i Alapai, he was saying, you know, now the road is reopened and he's worried that fishing will once again become a little harder because, you know, the fish aren't going to be so close up to the shore as people are in the water swimming.
So we have this report then that was released by the state. Any plans for future studies?
Yeah, so to that point about tourists coming, the state is currently looking at fish behavior related to the flood. And so they have data from before the flood, when the road was closed, and right now they're out there collecting data about now as some tourists come. They're going to look at fish behavior to, you know, find data to support, you know, to see if the data supports the idea that the fish aren't coming close up to the shore. And, you know, that could be used to make future determinations about how many tourists are allowed in the area.
Right, because this whole, I guess, conversation around over-tourism, again, like you mentioned, when we had these floods, people thought, oh, great, nature will get a break and maybe we'll heal. And so, you know, I'm sure a lot of things have bounced back. But again, as you mentioned, the studies have shown that not everything has bounced back.
Yeah, and as we know, climate change makes these intense storm events more frequent and more intense. And so this is kind of a peek into how future floods could affect the area, and it's not great.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, thanks so much. Lots of interesting stuff that came out of that conservation conference last week.
For sure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. That was reporter Claire Caulfield with today's Reality Check, a new voice at Honolulu Civil Beat. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, I'm Manjari Nirula from the World Crafts Council, Asia Pacific region, South Asia. You're listening to the conversation on member supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the program, we asked you to tell us what kind of paper Maui's L.L. Torbett used to make his own monetary system known as the Torbett script. Well, in 1848, Torbett did not approve of the fraction note system that was commonly used by island inhabitants and decided to create his own. His notes were in the amount of 25 cents, and each was hand-inked with his initials and the Roman numeral 25 beneath it. But there was a problem. Each note was very easy to counterfeit. In fact, a tax collector who had been paid by Torbett with his script was brought to court for counterfeiting. And although the magistrate let the tax collector off, Torbett was not so lucky and was ordered to cease production. The primary reason this system was so easy to forge was the paper used in its manufacturing. Torbett used small, fine squares of white tapa, or Indian paper, a very common item found throughout Hawaii at that time. And congratulations to Mike May. You got it right. And I think I might know you, Mike May. Thanks for listening. That's today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe surrounding our tiny planet, and also a rundown of things we can try and spot in our dark skies. Thankfully, we have astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the western sky after sunset. The moon this week is passing through its full phase.
And this week, you've got an update on a couple of space missions which were launched a long time ago.
Way back in 1977, two intrepid interplanetary explorers set off on a historic voyage. They were called Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Their mission was to explore the outer planets, and it revolutionized our understanding of our solar family. Upon conclusion of their primary mission, which was to last decades, these two robotic explorers would leave the solar system and head for interstellar space. Almost 50 years later, they are still in contact with NASA's Deep Space Network.
Considering how ancient that technology seems today that they had on board that thing, how is it possible?
Well, the spacecraft are powered by radioisotope thermoelectric generators, nuclear batteries, essentially. These power sources last for an incredibly long time as they rely on the controlled decay of radioactive elements. And both spacecraft still have most of their major instruments in operation. Until this week.
Ooh, what happened?
Engineers were forced to shut down Voyager 2's heating system for its cosmic ray instrument. But all is not lost because the spacecraft itself remains completely operational.
Can you imagine the size of the computer that's on board that thing? Must be just huge.
It absolutely is. And I guess it's testament to how well they built things back in the 70s.
Clearly.
In fact, both spacecraft report back to Earth on a regular basis, telling us about conditions in the outer solar system. And when I say outer, it's no exaggeration. These babies are 11 billion miles from home. Voyager 2 is officially in interstellar space.
How long will they continue to be functional?
We can expect them to remain in contact as long as their nuclear batteries hold out, which could still be a while. but these two explorers will most likely last longer than the human race.
And likely the first thing the aliens run into, huh?
You bet.
It's Christopher Phillips and a really revealing Stargazer this week. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
For at least a decade, Keep the Country Country has been a rallying cry that has divided some in the community against the development plans of the many changing owners of the Turtle Bay Resort. But much of that tension has been diffused of late. The resort has just announced it will allow the community to garden on its lands, Mauka, from the hotel entrance. It's partnering with Pono Pacific. Chris Lee sat down with us to explain how all this will work.
Pono Pacific started about 20 years ago. We're primarily focused on land conservation throughout the state. So we do a lot of work with large landowners, help them understand how to better steward their land and not necessarily help them tell them how to do it, but actually go out there and do it with them. This is a very unique opportunity, not only for Pono Pacific, but for the community as well in the North Shore. You may not know, or you may know, that 460 acres of agriculture lands on the Mauka side of the resort are a part of the hotel property. Over the years, you know, there's been a lot of opportunity for us to really see how we can bring back agriculture and support the initiative and the economy on the North Shore. So with Pono Pacific's partnership in the resort, we're really working hard in coordination with the community to see how and what is needed in order for us to make a revitalized area for agriculture.
Okay, so tell us about this lottery system that you folks have opened up.
The lottery is because there's been a lot of demand, a lot of interest in gardening. The resort has committed to providing 30 lots for community gardens to members of not only the resort, but the community, as well as organizations and nonprofits that are doing great work on the North Shore.
So what's involved and what's the process?
So we just actually announced it, and you can visit us at turtlebaycommunitygardens.org. You can register there. We want to try to make it fair and equal opportunity for everyone to have a chance at these gardens. So, you know, if there is a lot more interest in the future, you know, we can definitely look at opportunities and ways of expanding the program. But it is going to start here with these 30 plots. They're 10-foot by 50-foot plots. They have a nominal monthly fee of $10 with the upfront security deposit of $50, which is refundable. But, you know, again, it's not meant for anything other than to really bring the community back onto the land, allow people to get their hands in the soil, and to really see how they can produce and provide for their families and the community.
In that area, Keep Country Country has been a motto that we've heard over decades because there was this rub between the resort and the community.
It really goes back to the commitment to the North Shore community and recognizing what an important role they can play and do play on the North Shore. When you look at the history of the community, and it predominantly started off with agriculture, and as the plantation and monocrop industry had moved out, the resort played a vital role in maintaining jobs and that sort of thing. But what we do have the opportunity here is to really look at the agriculture component. And with 460 acres, you know, not only just provide for the community, but how it can impact the state as well. Really to also look at it as a model of how public and private partnerships and objectives can really move forward.
So one might ask, well, do we really need garden plots out there if it is country? Wouldn't people have their own backyard gardens?
Actually, no. Oddly enough, what we're realizing is that a lot of the residents there do not have the space to garden in their own backyards. The opportunity to have a community spot is not only to provide food, but also to engage with your neighbor and to learn from one another. One of the ways that we're looking at approaching the farms is really looking at how we can maximize the production out there, but providing not only the land, but also resources and support, but also the education side. So with the 30 community gardeners, what we're hoping is that they will work together, that they will look for opportunities to engage with one another on best practices for gardening, and also provide workshop opportunities for them as well to learn other things such as organic or Korean farming or even composting.
So will this be modeled after the community gardens that we see around town?
Yes and no. This is going to be a lot more open space. We didn't want it to be restricted off by fences or anything. We do have a ag fence around the entire community plot, which protects any pests or four-legged animals coming in. But we also wanted to keep it open. And again, where you're in your garden, you're right next to your neighbor's garden. So I think it's a little unique in that sense. You know, we also didn't really want to put a whole list of rules in there, right? You can't do this, you can't do that. What we wanted to be able to do is work together in partnership with the community, allow them to have input in how we facilitate and what we can do to support, their active engagement in the land.
So you kind of want this to grow organically, I guess.
Exactly. And again, I think, that's a commitment, on the Mauka land, is that it becomes a part of the community, something that is exposed and reopened and reinvigorated through this activity.
And you're trying to encourage the hotel employees to get involved as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great opportunity for the employees. You know, it's right across the street for them. It's within their own backyard, so to speak. And, I think you'll recognize a lot of them have been there for such a long time and haven't had an opportunity like this. And they are residents of the community, which is great.
Have you talked to any of the hotel workers, like what they might be interested in growing?
We have talked to some of the employees, and a lot of them are very excited just about being able to plant things that they can't access on the North Shore. They have to go to a specialty market. So there's going to be a variety of things that they can do and they want to do. So it's just a matter of them being creative and innovative in getting it in the ground.
So give us an example of what they might be interested in.
So I know a lot of people are looking at leafy greens. A lot of people are also looking at their own cultural ingredients for their families. So I there's a whole slew of different options that they've put in there. Karamungai was one of them. People were looking at microgreens, different opportunities that depends on how creative and how they want to utilize it.
Right. If they want bitter melon.
Bitter melon, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so as far as these plots, will there be a certain amount set aside for the nonprofits, a certain amount for the general public, and then the hotel workers?
Yes. So, we really wanted to give everyone an opportunity and didn't want it weighted too heavily or just the outcome of the lottery going to just one demographic or one area of the community. Right now we have 10 for the employees, but 10 also reserved for residents of the Kahuku area. And 10 for organizations and nonprofits that are doing work in that community. If there's less on one side and more on the other, then we'll open it up to everyone. And we certainly hope there is a lot of interest and know that there is a lot of interest right now. So if you do or are interested, visit us at turtlebaycommunitygardens.org and register there.
What about the hotel's efforts to maybe use some of the vegetables and the greens that are being grown there? How does that all work?
Well, there's opportunity, not necessarily directly with the community gardens, but we do want to work in partnership with the farmers. And one of the opportunities there is to provide food safety certifications and information so that they can certify their farms so that it can be purchased by the resort and to be honest with you, elsewhere. There's it can get a little technical now, but there's the Food Safety Modernization Act that's coming up. But there are people on the North Shore that are working to provide education and opportunity so farmers can get ahead of that.
Right. There's a big effort underway, I think, statewide to teach our farmers. They've been talking about this for some time. They've been classes saying There's a new federal rule. You've got to comply if you want to be able to sell your fruits and vegetables to restaurants and, big places like, Costco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really important. I think, there's been a lot of negative press lately on, foodborne illnesses and things coming out of produce especially. But, I think all of our farmers there have a commitment to providing clean and safe produce. But it's just a matter of consistency and best practices. And again, keeping up with, the information and the education that's out there.
To your knowledge, is this the first time that we've had like a resort do something like this?
To my knowledge, in Hawaii, yes. There's other partnerships on a smaller scale or other resorts or hotels on a smaller scale internationally that are doing something of this very similar.
Do you know where?
I know there's one in Cabo. I think it's called Flora Farms. There's a couple other ones that we were talking about, but nothing really to this magnitude. When you have 460 acres, that's a lot of land to be able to provide, not to just offset the needs of the community, again, but to make an impact across the state. state.
And that will really then actually go a long way toward the state's goals of sustainability.
No, absolutely, and that's our primary objective. Like I said, our first guiding principle in approaching this project really is maximizing the production. It doesn't only come in the form of edible foods, but we're also looking at opportunities for renewable energy and that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of potential and a lot of various ways that we could go about it. But the unique, again, opportunity that we have is to really bring the community onto the property for them to be able to see it and for them to be a part of it through the community gardens.
Is there room for tree crops?
There are. So not on the community gardens per se, but we do have opportunity for orchards along the Malka side of the property. We also want to look at reforestation and planting native trees back on property with, you know, anything from hala to milo and koa. Ohia, different opportunities with that as well. Currently, we have a lot of banana and papaya, which are fantastic. But there's other areas on the farm that aren't conducive to agriculture or to active agriculture. So we can use those spaces to impact other ways.
Okay, and then I guess it's also like just sharing info about pests and best practices all around.
Yes. So, you know, again, it goes through the relationships that all of us bring. Each of us have different networks that we belong to. And, you know, with Pono Pacific and the resort and the community, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for us to share and learn from one another. And I think that's the biggest part that makes it so special, is to have a place that belongs to that is on the North Shore in such a tight area that we can all work together and really learn from one another, enjoy in a shared practice. And at the end of the day, maybe be at the dinner table with one another.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing this.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the Turtle Bay Resort is making a total of 30 plots available. Winners will be drawn in the lottery next week, Friday, July 26th. So you need to apply soon. Head to our website for links.